maybe we can do introductions when we get the quorum, because the other item for the quorum is the House Chair has to be elected, and we have a quorum of House members, but we need a quorum of the entire body, which means we need a couple more members here. One more now, I think we need. So in any case, what I'm going to suggest we do is, instead of starting with introductions, maybe we'll start with the presentation of the report on the propane conversion strategy, unless we got a quorum of the entire body here now. There's a quorum is present, and with that, maybe what we should do is first have quickly do introductions, and then I will ask for nominations for the House for a nomination for the House Chair, and then we'll take that up, because we do now have a quorum of the entire body and a quorum of the House, half of the body. And with that, Annie Levinson Falk is our executive director, who you will, those of you who haven't met, will meet, and she's going to be making the presentation in a couple minutes. But do I have any nominations from the House for chair, the House Chair of the Commission?
Mr. Chair, I would nominate Representative Pat Garofalo to be the chair of the House side.
The name of Pat Garofalo has been nominated. Are there any other nominations? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Division.
You can't vote.
I know I can.
With that, congratulations, Representative Garofalo. And we will, just for new members, we're hoping to meet a couple of times during session, maybe early in the session particularly, but this one we wanted to get in right away because the commission asked, the commission was asked in legislation to do a study of propane conversion, and the study was completed a few weeks ago, and Ms. Levinson-Falk, do you want to start with that, or did you want to approve the minutes? We got a quorum of the body. We have minutes from the last several meetings in the packets that have not been approved.
Mr. Chair, do we need to do them one at a time, or can we do them in a pack?
Unless there's objection, my committees don't usually, let's do it as a pack unless anybody.
Okay. Do them all.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'd move adoption of the minutes in the packets.
From June, July, August, September, November, and December, and January, and
August.
We don't have minutes from today. Yes. All those in favor of approving the minutes, say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. Do we want to quickly do an introduction of committee members? Because I think Representative Anderson's probably the only one who some Senate members may not know. But does everybody else know each other enough?
Let's start.
Okay. Well, go ahead. Maybe
John Petersburg from 24A.
Gene Wiginius, Minneapolis and Richfield.
Chris Lozinski, 16A.
Tim Mahoney, East
Sanctuary Park. I'm Paul Anderson, District 12B, which is out in the ag country.
Melissa Hartman, Brooklyn Park and Coon Rapids.
Pat Garofalo, Farmington and portions of rural Dakota and Goodhue counties.
John Marty from Roseville.
Jim Benson, South St. Paul, West St. Paul, Mendota Heights, Mendota, hard to begin. That's enough.
Julie Rosen, serving Watonwan County, half of Jackson, all of Martin, all of Faribault, all of Blue Earth, except the town of Mankato, all of Waseca, except the town of Waseca.
I think you should name all the townships you represent.
And a little of Sir.
And with that, Ms. Levinson-Falk, did you want to do a brief report to the commission on meetings or anything like that?
Not at this time, unless there are any questions.
Okay, then maybe just go ahead and begin with the report.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the Commission. I am Anne Falk, Executive Director of the Legislative Energy Commission, and I'm here to present a report on propane conversion strategies. This report was requested last year by the legislature, a bill carried by Senator Scoy. I don't know if he's here today. The purpose was to investigate ways in which the legislature could help Minnesota users of propane convert to natural gas or another alternative source of energy. This comes, Senator Sewell. This came during the propane shortage and price spikes that we had last winter that I think everybody remembers. The report does not address propane supply strategies, market strategies, or distributor business practices. It's not a statement on the importance of any of those issues. It's just outside of the scope of the legislative request. What we found is that there is, not surprisingly, no single answer to propane conversion. And so what this report presents is a menu of options that the legislature might like to consider, and none of these have been endorsed by the LEC or its staff. Now, before I start, I'd like to just acknowledge that this reflects input from dozens of leaders in the industry, government, research, nonprofits, agriculture, and many other areas. I'm not an expert in any of these particular energy areas, but I've done my best to compile information from those who are. And I'll answer the questions today to the best of my ability. If you have detailed questions on any of these areas, I'd be happy to look farther into it. So first, what I'd like to cover is a little bit of background on how Minnesota propane is used, so we know what kinds of customers we're talking about converting their heating fuels, and then a discussion of alternatives. First, looking at conservation and ways that we could use less energy no matter what the source, natural gas system expansions, and then a number of delivered and distributed resources, including solar thermal, woody biomass, electric heating, and district heating and waste heat recovery. I'm going to cover a lot of options and try to do it in a fairly short amount of time. So I'm not going to go in depth on quite a number of them. And if I skip over anything that you'd like to hear more about, please don't hesitate to stop me and ask. So first, looking at propane use in Minnesota, we use approximately 400 million gallons of propane a year. That varies quite a bit depending on the weather. You can see just between 2012 and the estimate for 2014, that varied about 60%. So it's very weather dependent. And the cost of this reflects about $600 million per year. Actually, in 2012, we spent $612 million on propane. You can see that was a relatively low use year. So that's a pretty conservative number. And Minnesota has no fossil fuel resources inside the state, so all of that money is spent to import propane from places outside of Minnesota. If you look at how that didn't work out very well, you have in your handouts a copy that has the actual percentages in it. How that breaks down by sector, you see that a majority of the largest share, I should say, of propane in Minnesota is used in residences for space heating, water heating, cooking, and things like that. The second largest use is agriculture, and that is primarily corn drying in the fall, followed by heating livestock farms, especially poultry. If you look at how the residential use of propane is distributed around the state, you can see some areas of concentration. As you know, this is mainly a rural issue. There's a lot of areas in the northwest and southern regions of the state that heat with propane. On the whole, it's about 10% of Minnesota residences that primarily use propane for heat. And this is really more an issue of geography rather than income. We broke it down by income levels and found that it's a pretty consistent 8 to 12% of any income level that uses propane for heat. As we know, we saw a shortage of propane last winter that was due to a number of different factors. We had the highest demand for propane in a decade, which I think caught everybody a little bit off guard. It was due to a corn harvest that was very large and also late in the season and damp. So we used a lot of propane for crop drying that year, and it came very close to the winter and didn't leave enough time for stocks to be replenished. Very cold weather, which I don't need to remind anybody. Much greater use of propane by large customers that primarily use natural gas. Natural gas utilities have so-called interruptible customers that they can call on to stop their natural gas usage when there's supplies are tight for them. And a lot of those A lot of those customers then switch over to propane, and they can use multiple semi-truckloads of propane in one day. And just for comparison, one semi-truckload is enough to heat about 20 homes for a month. So they use really a lot of propane. Finally, the Cochin pipeline that carried nearly 40% of Minnesota's propane in previous years was shut down in March, and it was closed around November and December for a few weeks for maintenance and preparation for that. The company did postpone that maintenance shutdown in order to accommodate the crop drying season, but it still came at a difficult time in the very cold winter. So I should also say that since last winter, the industry has done a lot to accommodate this shift, especially the loss of the Cochin pipeline. They've expanded rail terminals and built increased storage so that to prepare for this season. This graph shows what last year's shortage did to prices. If you look over the last 10 years or so, average propane prices in Minnesota stayed about $150 to $225, more or less. And then you see that enormous spike around January of 2014 went up to a high of $4.61 a gallon. And some local markets probably saw higher prices than that. Before I move on to heating alternatives, there are a lot of questions about whether we can make better use of heating assistance funds for low-income households. So we have a low-income heating assistance energy program, heating energy assistance program, LIHEAP, funded by the federal government. And the state uses those federal funds to help purchase propane and other heating fuels for low-income households. The LIHEAP funds come in the fall after the start of the federal fiscal year, October 1st. Propane prices are generally lower during the summer, which is why all customers are encouraged to fill their tanks over the summer. So we have a lot of questions about could we somehow use those LIHEAP funds earlier in the year and get a better rate. We are not, as a state, allowed to have propane delivered before October 1st and then pay for it with the next federal fiscal year's funding. So that's a bit of a sticking point, but there are a few different ways to get around that. I think they mainly break down into three options that the legislature could consider. One is to use state funds before October 1st, so over the summer, or if there are distributors willing to offer a line of credit to the state for reimbursement when the federal funds come in. We can purchase that propane over the summer and have it delivered in the fall. It can't be delivered before October 1st, but if it's delivered after October 1st, then you are able to reimburse that with federal funds. That would probably require a kind of a one-time state appropriation so that we could cover that period from using state funds to when it's reimbursed. Another option would be to reserve some federal funds when they come in to be used the next season. The downside there is that then you have less funding available during the wintertime. So I would suggest the way to get around that is, again, a one-time state appropriation in that first year. So, for example, the state of Wisconsin does this. They withhold, I think this year it's $5 million in the fall, and then they use that to buy summer fills the next summer. The state of Minnesota could appropriate $5 million for summer fills this summer and then withhold an equal amount in following years. Finally, this could be done entirely with state funds. And I should note that the authority does exist for the Department of Commerce to run a propane pre-purchase program. It was run in around 2006, I believe, is the year. Unfortunately, that year, prices actually went down over the season rather than up, so that it did report a loss. That's not a typical of a typical propane season. So now looking at alternatives. Again, with any energy consideration, usually the most cost-effective thing to do is use less of the energy. So looking at conservation, the key challenge here is that there is an upfront cost. So even if this is are measures that people can do in their homes or businesses or farms that will save money over the long term, it can be hard to come up with that money upfront, and especially for folks who are price sensitive and going to be affected the hardest by increases in heating costs. Two options here. The first one looks at creating a rural heating conservation program. So the state, as part of our energy policy, requires utilities to have a conservation improvement programs that save 1.5% of the energy that would otherwise be sold each year. So if you have a natural gas utility service, you can go to your utility for incentives on energy-saving measures in your house. Most customers outside of natural gas utilities don't have these heating incentives if they are using a delivered fuel like propane. It is available to some degree to low-income customers, but on the whole, you don't have the same access to conservation incentives. So the option number two here looks at creating a rural heating conservation program that would make those incentives available to propane customers. It could be administered statewide by the Department of Commerce and available on a local level at local agencies. I would suggest considering requiring a certain portion of the funds to support low and lower middle income homeowners. And I did a rough estimate of costs. If you were to fund such a program with a 1 cent per therm charge on propane deliveries, it could raise approximately $2 to $4 million a year while adding $7 to $10 to an average household's yearly propane bill. Although I would suggest that if this program were to be created, it would also cover fuel oil customers as well, in which case you could either lower that rate or raise additional budget. Option three on this slide looks at the weatherization assistance program, which is another federally funded program to help with low-income weatherization for homes. Minnesota state funds make up 9% of the program's budget, which is far below the national average of 39%. And those are mostly actually funds from our utilities and not from the state government. So one option there would be to look at appropriating additional state funding for the weatherization assistance program. Turning now to natural gas, I think this was a main interest in requesting this report. So I looked at the feasibility of converting propane customers to natural gas through expansions of the natural gas system. For those of you who were members of the Legislative Energy Commission in July, you remember a presentation from Commissioner Wergen of the Public Utilities Commission where she went over how natural gas regulation works in Minnesota. We don't have a universal service requirement the way there is for electricity. If it's not cost-effective for a natural gas utility to extend into an area, there will not be natural gas service there. And the cost of expanding to the system has to be covered by new customers. It can't be shared across a utility's rate base. Unfortunately, it is not likely to be cost-effective in many areas of rural Minnesota, because there is not the population density and the density of gas usage that's really needed to make these projects fundable. However, there were a few extensions last year, and there may be some things that the legislature could do if it wished to make natural gas system expansions feasible in some new areas. The main challenges to natural gas system expansions, again, is price. It's the price of the infrastructure, the pipeline system, and there are some customer costs as customers need to upgrade their appliances to convert to natural gas.
Ms. Levinson-Falk, yes. Just a question on the previous page, the grid of where the big pipelines are.
Yes.
Obviously, the huge cost of natural gas is the big pipelines, but to get it from just looking at the chart, one of the big ones to Bagley. Is Bagley covered, for instance, are they served by natural gas? And if so, the little pipelines to go to the smaller communities that aren't served, I assume there's the mid-sized grid that goes off of this grid, and then from there the smaller ones. To extend it to the towns like that I can't remember who was expanding it, XL or whomever, to some more accounts, how much does it cost? I mean, are we measuring in tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars per quarter mile? Or how much are these distribution lines costing? Do you know any idea about that?
Mr. Chair and members of the commission, with respect to Bagley, I don't know the answer there. I could find that out. And I also, I couldn't give you an accurate estimate of the price of... Perhaps Senator Skoy could enlighten us.
Welcome to the commission, Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This report is a result of a bill that I carried, so I am interested in your report. And thank you. With regard to Bagley and the surrounding communities, it's actually why I had an interest in expanding the natural gas to begin with, because Bagley, Fauston, and Clearbrook went together and cooperatively put together one tap on the main line and then serviced all three communities off that one tap. Taking the gas from the tap to the city of Clearbrook, which has a nursing home, a school, and a fairly large industrial user, it's an ag processing facility, is only down a 2-inch plastic line. It's amazing. And so the cost of those smaller lines isn't all that bad. The line comes on a coil, they plow it in, they use their underground boring machines to go under the tar roads, and those three communities went together and put natural gas into those towns. And they also provided service to any of the farmsteads that were along those lines at the time of installation. If you want to hook up later now, you have to pay that cost. But that's actually what got me thinking about this during the propane price increase of last year, is I thought, well, if those three communities can do this, there has to be other communities out there that would be close to being able to finance it. And if we could just give them a little bit of help, maybe they could get there and utilize the huge amount of natural gas that's being produced in North Dakota that they've been burning off, but they're not going to be allowed to do in the future because of permitting. And they're going to have to go somewhere with it. Well, they might as well come into Minnesota and we can heat homes with it. So. But Bagley is serviced, and Clearbrook and Fauston are the three communities that went together.
So do you know what, for like a residential customer there, how much more, because they're paying the entire cost of the expansion. I mean, the residents, I was curious.
You know, I don't know the cost, Mr. Chair, but I'm going to guess it wasn't significant or they wouldn't have been able to do it because, right. I mean, these not, they're not real high, well-to-do communities.
Mr. Chair, if I could add, the way that these are typically financed for an investor-owned gas utility is through what's called a new area surcharge. So it's a surcharge onto the new customer's bills. And that's typically under $30 a month, but can run for 15 to 30 years.
Okay. I just wanted to interrupt before you got into how you might share these costs and so on. So continue where you were. I'm sorry.
Yeah, and I should note that... the areas that would be most feasible for gas expansion are the ones that are close to these interstate pipelines already and have one or more large customers that could anchor a system.
Excuse me, sir. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just an addition here. It's not just the cost of adding these smaller lines off the main lines. As an example, the elevator back in my hometown put in a new corn dryer 2 years ago, and they're on close to that one main line. But the capacity of the main line would not allow the corn dryer to be run on natural gas. They had to go to propane because the capacity on that line was already nearly maxed out. So we have to look at the capacity of our main lines as well.
And Representative Mahoney, then Representative Hood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, do we know? I mean, you said that they have to be close by these trunk lines. And Senator Skoy mentioned the three towns that tapped off the one line. Are there other towns that are close enough or in that same type situation that you could get two or three? And I'm sure Marshall is served by natural gas, but are there three other towns or two other towns that, if we're going to do some kind of a credit, we're not going to do unlimited, we're going to do it a small base for 1 year and 2 years and 3 years. So how many of these town type things are there, town setups are there like that, that could happen?
Representative Swierczynski wanted to comment.
I just want to go back to the previous question. My in-laws who live in Senator Brown's district, city of Gilman, they're just north of Foley, and the city itself partnered with a farmer that was up the road, and then so the farmer paid for half of the main line coming up, and then the city connected on as an addition. And I just texted her, and she said the base cost for as a homeowner just to kind of have the option to do it was $250. So just an upfront free of $250.
You probably don't even need a tax credit.
Yeah, but that's what it was. And then I think, she said they save on average like $79 a month over the year from what they were paying for propane when they switched over. So they did it right during this period. So
before we get to Ms. Govinson-Falk, Representative Hortman.
Mr. Chair, on July 28th when we were up at in Pine River, the testifier from Excel who was extending service into the city of Pillager was Chris Conrad, and he talked about the cost per consumer, and he also talked about the difference in cost for the furnaces and then what the projected savings are. So maybe if Ms. Levinson-Falk could get in touch with Chris Conrad and have him give us in writing the information we received orally at that meeting, and we could distribute it to members so they get an idea. Because we just heard about this in July, but I can't remember the numbers.
I can't either, so thank you. Ms. Govinson-Falk, please continue.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the Commission, I would be happy to do that. So I'm going to focus primarily here on the system costs. I think something to change the system costs or how those are shared would be likely to have the greatest impact. So as I said, all expansions must be covered by the new customers, so that gas utility. The legislature could consider allowing those costs to be shared across utility customers, either built into rates for that utility or allowing utilities to build up an expansion fund of some sort. And so that would be a direction to the Public Utilities Commission to allow that. So because much of rural Minnesota is going to continue to not be served by natural gas utilities, you have to then look at what are the delivered and distributed options and alternatives to propane. I cover four here: solar thermal, woody biomass, off-peak electric thermal storage, and district heating and combined heat and power. And I'm going to do this as quickly as possible so that we can have plenty of time for your questions. But I do want to note that these, in contrast to propane, can be all served with Minnesota resources. In general, many of these options face similar barriers. It comes down to the upfront costs and a lack of awareness or understanding of the option. There are a number of possibilities for how to address both of those. In addressing the costs, I'll just focus on option number 10. This is an existing program, the Renewable Energy Equipment Grant Program. It has $150,000 in funding a year in grants to providers of low-income weatherization assistance to help people install renewable energy equipment in their homes, so something like a wood stove or something of that effect. This, even though it's only $150,000, the grants are not, to my understanding, it's being underutilized. And some advocates report that that's because the weatherization assistance providers are simply stretched too thin and they can't handle one more grant program to give out. So one simple way to deal with that may be just opening up who has access to those grants to additional agencies that work with low-income Minnesotans. This program, to be continued at all, it does need to be renewed by the legislature this year. I want to note that the state agencies are running the CZO program as Climate Strategies and Economic Opportunities. It's looking at various strategies to deal with climate issues and what the job impacts of those would be. Some of those, of course, overlap with energy, including one that has an impact here. They are looking at a straw man proposal that would establish a statewide renewable thermal goal. So along with the renewable electricity goal, we'd have a goal for renewable heating and cooling energy. And I expect to see the results of that study sometime within the next couple of months. So to look at the specific technologies, these are in no particular order, but looking first at solar thermal, this is separate from solar PV photovoltaic technology. It doesn't generate electricity. It simply captures the heat from sunlight and then transfers that either as warm air or hot water into a building. For those that were at the meeting in July, we did visit this airport here that you're looking at, so that might look familiar. In addition to the options that I just discussed, the Department of Commerce did a review of solar thermal and found that there are installation costs that are due to kind of permitting and building barriers. So the legislature could act to streamline permitting. Right now, that each local jurisdiction has many different permitting for solar thermal installation, or to have some sort of a solar-ready building requirement in the building. I should also note that solar thermal, it is supplemental to propane. It can't provide 100% of a building's heat, but it can be a cost-effective alternative in some situations to reduce your usage of propane. An installer in Minnesota, says that on a typical good site, it can pay off in over a course of about 10 years. Another alternative would be wood, either firewood, chips, or pellets, as shown here. This is most cost-effective in the forested areas of the state. It's not cost-effective once you start looking at transporting wood great distances. Probably within 100 miles or less is best. In addition to the general suggestions, one option, I should say a barrier that does tend to impede woody biomass conversions is the technical analysis that's needed for that kind of a system, especially on a larger scale, community scale, like a school or a nursing home or something of that size. And the state has found a useful role in helping with that, led by the Department of Natural Resources. So one option there would be to continue state funding for technical assistance, especially through the Next Gen board. Electricity can sometimes be a cost-effective alternative to propane. It is expensive to use electric heat if you're using it all the time, but many utilities, especially the cooperative utilities, offer off-peak electric rates for when their electric prices are lower. They can pass that along to their members. So overnight, for customers that are on off-peak rates, they can buy power at a much lower cost and put it in heaters, either air or water heaters that store it, and then release that warm air or warm water when it's needed. The picture of the water heater here, that kind of a electric storage water heater is going to be disallowed under new efficiency rules from the federal level in April if there's not action on the federal level there.
On that, people are asking about that. In other words, several of the co-ops already have such a thing where they're using large water heaters and they're just storing heat at night and using it. You said the federal law will not allow that after a certain date. Could you speak more to that, or what you know?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members of the commission. There are new proposed efficiency regulations for water heaters that are not going to allow the type of water heater that's used for this kind of a program, the size or the specifications that are needed for this. And I know that Minnesota cooperative utilities are working hard to a change in that regulation at the federal level, but so far it's still in place.
Mr. Chair. I can't remember, but I thought sometime in the last 2 years the members of the LEC signed a letter together to our federal delegation, or maybe we just talked about doing that. I know, I think our entire federal delegation is on board, but I'm not sure that they're aware of the urgency of the issue. It's something we could think about doing to communicate the urgency of this, especially in the areas that are served by co-ops. So maybe if our executive director could look into whether we did that before and whether we should do it again.
Mr. Chair, Representative Portman, I would be happy to do that. That was something that was considered last year, but the members did not actually send a letter.
Senator Thomasoni.
Ms. Levinson-Falk, so are we talking about the tanks that are currently installed or just new ones that would be purchased?
Mr. Chair and Senator Thomasoni, it would be for new purchases.
Ms. Levinson-Falk, what is it? Is it just, it's not electric water heaters in general. Is there a certain size? What are the restrictions that are they're deeming energy inefficient?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Chair Garofalo, I believe it is a size restriction. It's not electric water heaters in general. I don't have all the specifics, but I can find out.
Okay, thanks.
Finally, I'll talk about district heating and waste heat recovery. These are somewhat separate but related options. St. Paul, for example, it has district heating and cooling system. The Capitol is heated and cooled on that system. The thermal energy is created at a central plant and then distributed throughout a community in hot water, cooled water, or steam. This can be done in conjunction with production of power, so capturing waste heat off of a power plant and using that to heat buildings nearby. That's called combined heat and power. Or it can be done simply by producing thermal energy separately. It can use any number of different fuels, including coal, natural gas, biomass, and solar thermal. It can use multiple different generation sources on one system. You can get much larger efficiencies in doing this than traditional power production or 100s of separate heaters in each building. So it is a much greater efficiency this way. The key challenge here is sometimes finding financing for the last little bit. People who companies that are in district energy say that they can often line up almost all of the funding that's needed, but they have trouble finding financing that is over a long enough period and at a rate that is cost-effective for them. So the state could provide some patient or long-term capital to help some of these projects get over the last hump. I still want to highlight, again, a few proposals in the CZO project that are relevant to this that you may be hearing about more later. They're looking at a number of combined heat and power options, including requiring utilities to consider combined heat and power in their integrated resource planning, requiring utilities to promote it through their conservation improvement programs, and if there were a renewable energy standard to even include a combined heat and power, renewable thermal, include a combined heat and power goal in the RES. The Department of Commerce also has an ongoing stakeholder process on combined heat and power, so this may be something that you're hearing more about. With that, I'll conclude, and I'd be happy to take any questions now or also to speak with any of you or any legislators at another time about any of these options.
Thank you. And one thing I think it would be, I mean, in addition to following up about getting the information when you talked to Mr. Conrad, just to get a sense of what communities, because again, he gave them to us orally last summer, but would like to know what communities he was thinking about. And I think Representative Anderson's point about how often, when some of the main trunk lines don't have the capacity, I'm just curious, is that common in many parts of the state or just his area? And I also wonder, have you heard anything recently on, I haven't heard anything spiking in propane prices this year, but I assume the supply is doing okay because the weather's been cooperating. Have you been in touch with administration or anyone on that?
Mr. Chair, I haven't looked at the prices lately, but I haven't heard of any price spikes.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of comments. You mentioned the propane supply. Yes, the corn harvest was better this year, not as much propane used for that. The weather has been warmer. But I think we should also recognize that a lot of companies added additional storage for propane. Again, back home, a company put in 90,000-gallon tanks and a brand-new rail unloading facility. So there's been a lot of work done to improve the availability of propane. Just one additional comment. We had a slide on the woody biomass. And as I understand, I've been talking to a constituent, there are new EPA guidelines set to begin taking effect in February next month that pertain to wood-burning stoves. And he's concerned that when these are fully implemented, I think it's over a five-year period, it's going to be difficult to have a stove that will meet all these standards. So we should look at that. I would encourage that to see if we can encourage, again, some leeway in these standards, because a lot of folks do heat with wood here in Minnesota.
Thank you. Other questions or comments or suggestions from members of the commission? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Anderson, would that include other biomass that's heating, being heated through the stove, too, or just woody?
Well, as far as I know, wood stoves, but there's a new set of guidelines, and it involves reburning the smoke going up the chimney, as I understand, and it's going to really affect the draft on these stoves. It's going to take new design changes, very difficult to attain these standards, but I don't know if it pertains to other things than just wood.
We don't have any future meetings scheduled, I understand, but if members of the commission have any suggestions or whatever, please get in touch with either Representative Garofalo or myself, and Ms. Levinson-Falk has been meeting. I think when she was first hired, she made the rounds of all the members of the commission, and so members who have not been on it more recently, I'm sure she'll be making the rounds of your offices as well. But please keep in touch, and we don't have the next meeting scheduled, but we will send you notice as soon as there is. With that, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you.